Welcome to the United Methodist Church of Kent Sermon Podcast. During the season of Lent, we will have a bonus podcast episode each week, in addition to the Sunday sermon. Please enjoy this bonus episode.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started tonight. Fourth in our Lenten series. Tonight we're going to be talking in terms of God's concerns about children. And the topic for tonight is what happened to the orphanage. And so tonight we have Reverend Jared Godomsky Littleton.
Absolutely right.
All right. He's the United Methodist Elder and is the chaplain to the Agency for Ohio Guidestone. He has previously served Independence United Methodist Church as their pastor and the Cleveland Clinic as a chaplain resident. Reverend Godomsky Littleton received his Master's of Divinity from Methodist Theological School in Ohio and resides in Cleveland with his wife Danielle and son Elijah.
Thank you. Obviously, it's a big booming microphone and it's a small crowd, but I know they want to record it for podcast, I guess, is my understanding. This is going to be very informal. Stop me at any time so that we can talk through. It's interesting because the topic, whatever happened to the orphanage, I think I read that about 10 minutes ago, that apparently that's the topic. So assuming that that's referring specifically to the organization that's now Ohio Guidestone, I can tell you a lot about that. When it comes to the issue of what has happened to orphans in general, I can give you a lot of opinions on that that may or may not be backed up in any fact, but I'll try to give it to you anyways. But what I wanted to get started with tonight is to show you a short video that we produced just a few years ago when Ohio Guidestone was celebrating its 150th anniversary. And that'll just give you a little bit of an overview for the talk that is to come.
Hope. Impact. 150 years ago, through the need to help orphaned children, a great organization was born. Today, Ohio Guidestone has a 150-year legacy of providing care, hope, and impact to generations of children and families across the state of Ohio. In 1864,
the German Methodist Orphan Asylum opened its doors. The home gave orphaned children from all over the country not only a home, but a proper upbringing.
I never knew any place that was as nice as this. Ma Care put it point blank to us. She gave us a place to live. To live, okay, not just exist.
Children attended school and learned skills to become self-sufficient. In the 1920s, children of similar ages began living in cottage-style homes to create more family-centered living and an increased sense of community.
It was a great experience to come here. There was much more support, much more structure. The idea we lived in cottages, even though we lived here, we were much entwined in the community. We went to the public schools, we attended the churches, obviously, here.
In 1959, a time when emotional problems were steadily increasing, Ohio Guidestone shifted its focus to become a residential treatment program. As residential treatment grew, it became increasingly clear that a wide-ranging approach was needed to treat the children. Caseworkers, foster care, group home programming, and counselors began working to meet the needs of our changing society and our children.
It stayed relevant by responding to the needs of our community and the people that we serve and the needs that emerge as societies evolve.
I would tell you that we are always looking for new ways to do things better, that we never sit on our laurels, and that as society changes, we change with it.
We've increased our emphasis on prevention and keeping kids in the family home, providing a ministry of healing and nurturing to children and their families in a setting that enables them to grow and become more productive individuals. Education has become a focal point, providing a comprehensive solution, not just treatment, to the problems that our community faces. In 2012, Ohio Guidestone opened Stepstone Academy, in Cleveland's central neighborhood. StepStone's innovative approach to education supports the academic achievement of high-need urban students. Flora, a foster parent, chose StepStone Academy for her foster daughter, Maxine.
Maxine is a child that has some, at that time, well, she really has some emotional problems or challenges, and she has an IEP, and so she has some academic challenges. In the first grade, she could only recognize 6 alphabets and 3 numbers. When she was promoted to second grade, she could read an entire book. The teachers, they are so excited about learning and teaching, and they take the time out with each child as an individual to find out, assess them, and find out what their weaknesses and strengths are, and then they build upon what they have found out for that individual child.
What's that so called? There he is, four, five, six, that's the step so way. For the step to success. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, let's go.
StepStone, I can't say enough more, more about it.
An emphasis on skill building programs like work readiness training allow participants to change their life circumstances and move forward on a new path.
My childhood was unstable. I mean, I had a working mom, but she wasn't there a lot because she worked to maintain the bills. And so a lot of my childhood was spent along with, like, my older siblings. Like, we moved from school to school, from house to house. She had other issues. She was dealing with issues like alcohol and drugs. My brother passed in 2005. My dad passed in 2009, 2 days before I had my son. We found out that he had cancer like a month before he passed.
Through our Workforce 360 services, our participants learn skills to meet their employment goals, as well as guidance and coaching to achieve long-term success.
In the Youth Build program, we learned a lot about construction, leadership, taking ownership, being independent, and also being a team player, cooperation, a lot of discipline, learning that, you know, we can't go beyond the point where we're at now. After this program, I know that my kids will be able to say that, you know, my mom started something and she finished it. Without this program, I wouldn't be in a GED setting like now. Without this program, I probably wouldn't be thinking about my future dreams and aspirations.
My hope for them is to break the cycle. You know, a lot of them are coming from backgrounds that it's just over and over again generational, where it's low income, poverty, incarceration. It's just a lot. And my hope is just to break the cycle, just this, so they can show their kids that, you know, it doesn't have to keep going.
Home-based family treatment provides intensive child, youth, and family therapy in the family home by experienced and empathetic counselors. Focusing on critical problems and solutions, we give families the tools to better meet everyday responsibilities and become less overwhelmed. Parents Randy and Jamil's 5-week-old son died suddenly in their home. This traumatic event has impacted them and their other 3 children. Ohio Guidestone worked with the family to help them through this tragedy.
In October, we had a 5-week-old who passed away, who had 2 brothers and a sister. They were all in the house and very close with him. So that like triggered really strong emotions in them. And we were both addicts at the time. We sent the children to be with his mom so that we could like straighten up our lives and be parents to them. My relationship with him was very strained because I was very scared to get attached to him.
They provided a lot of services, and it actually went beyond, you know, just the children. They actually helped me and Randy. So it was really, really, it was terrific for us.
It was very hard for me to be a good mother to them because I had so much that I was dealing with inside that
I didn't know how to, like, love them. I loved them, but I didn't know how to be there for them because I was dealing with my own things.
It's changed me tenfold, you know, emotionally, mentally. It's really, really helped me, and I've seen a 1 to 10 change in me, and I don't think it would have been possible without Ohio Guidestone.
In our 150 years, we have served over 100,000 clients to make our community stronger, to make their lives stronger, to make their families stronger. And we move forward with a positive outlook and the certainty that we will continue to change and improve to better serve those in need of help. This is our legacy, and you are our hope. Support us today and be a part of our future. Our continued success in changing lives depends on your generous support. We can't do it without you.
So I'd like to have a little bit of a show before we tell, and so that we can get a feel for some of the things. Now, it went really, really fast from the beginning to where we are today. So I just wanted to take some time because I was told that that was a special area of interest. It was just how Ohio Guidestone has evolved over the years. So we were founded in 1864, and there are a number of different Methodist-related children homes founded in that time period. So before I tell you anything, I'm going to start with questions. Why do you think so many were founded in that time?
Civil War.
Civil War, absolutely. Flat Rock Children's Homes, which is the other, United Methodist-related institution here in East Ohio, has a similar date. That following the Civil War, of course, we know just how much of a massacre that was, and so how many children were faced with the environment of not having parents. Now, it's usually not having parents to help raise them, and so there was a real need. So in 1864, Berea resident Reverend William Aarons began discussing the founding of an orphan asylum, as the term they used at that time in Berea. The home was going to be for children whose fathers were killed in the Civil War or from working in the local quarries. I think we don't realize just how dangerous so much of work was at that time. So the German Methodist Orphan Asylum, as it was called at that time, was founded March 4th of 1864. So the first orphan to be received at the home was Mary Bletch on May 1st, 1864, who remained there for 12 years. Two boys followed her the next day, and they came from Kansas, where their father had been murdered in a particular incident. And so children came from all over the country because there weren't that many places at that time. So the original mission of the German Methodist Orphan Asylum was to receive orphans or other children, as the bylaws may designate, in order to care for their bodies and minds in the best possible manner, and to educate and fit them for their temporal and external welfare. So when it began, it was just one large home in which the children were cared for together. But as it grew, and over time, they found the need, obviously, to supply more than just a home. So they founded in 1905 the Ott Memorial Manual Training School. And the building was built and contained a completely equipped manual training shop for classes in woodworking, drafting, ironworking, and horseshoeing. The school included a gymnasium with a running track, exercise bars, gym paraphernalia of the time. It also had a swimming pool in which everyone was expected to learn how to swim. There aren't that many schools with swimming pools anymore. The building was later sold to Baldwin Wallace University to be used as classrooms and was torn down in 1982. It's interesting that they have sort of a schedule from that time. So the children, well, here's a typical day for the children living in that area. At 4 a.m., the laundry boys would begin the day's washing. So it's not a new thing, men, that we're supposed to do laundry. It is an ancient tradition. Don't even try to pull but that isn't part of our work. At 5:30 a.m., the laundry girls folded and hung the clothes. The older boys fed the animals and milked the cows. The powerhouse boys started and maintained the coal furnaces. At 6:30 a.m., the older girls made milk, toast, cereal, and pancakes, and fruit for breakfast. 8 a.m., they headed off to school, and they went to the local school system. We didn't have though they had that manual school for those who needed to learn a trade, they would go to the local schools. At 3:30 p.m., the kitchen girls cooked dinner under the supervision of the head cook. At 5 p.m., the house kids picked up the yard and swept the basement stairs. At 6, children washed the dinner dishes and started their homework. 7:30 was bedtime for the youngest, and 9:30 bedtime for the oldest children. And thus, I think in some ways, though of course it was not the same as being with one's family. It's never the same. That's really a theme throughout. These children, in many senses, at least as it was described, seemed to be fairly typical children. They just didn't have a parent. And so they tried to make their lives as typical as possible. And that really sounds like the schedule. My mom grew up on a farm. My grandparents were farmers. And so sort of that farmer agrarian lifestyle. So it was and they lived in this one facility, but it was in the 1920s when they began to make the move from what we traditionally think of as an orphanage, which I think when you picture, well, let me ask this. What do you picture when you picture an orphanage? Okay. A huge, great big house where they did everything there.
I think traditionally, I think of like a big dormitory, you know, where there are rows of beds.
A big dormitory with rows of beds. Any other thoughts? And I think that those are accurate pictures. What evolved was the realization, I believe at some level, is that though they tried to make life as typical as possible, that isn't typical life for kids. So in the 1920s, yes. Mm-hmm. Right. So it was the comment was it's very, very structured. Everybody did things at the same time, and it was all very much in order, which I have a five-month-old at home. My house is not that orderly, I can say. So it was in the 1920s that they decided to change it up a bit, and the decision was made to put children of similar ages into groups, creating a more home-like environment. This led to the construction of cottage-style homes, beginning with the Mueller-Leppert Cottage in 1928, which is still a cottage on our campus that is used to this day, and three others in the 1930s. The children attended public school, community church, and lived with house parents. Overall, this provided more family-centered living and more community. Again, the move was towards, can we get this to look a little bit more like family? In 1937, the home was no longer serving just orphans, but also troubled children with parents. And so the agency changed its name to the Methodist Children's Home to reflect the change in service. So if the question is whatever happened to the orphanage, I'd point all the way back to 1937 when it began to expand its vision, not just children without parents, but children and families who struggle and need additional help. So what that takes us to after that, and as we begin that move towards children and families who struggle, we look at as a country as a whole, a big movement going on. Now the video referred to in the 1950s, children and families began to experience more emotional troubles. I'm not going to disagree exactly with that. I'm going to restate it. I think we began to recognize emotional struggles. One of the interesting things I've learned as a chaplain is the history of trauma. What we refer to now as PTSD, PTSD is a relatively recent diagnosis. It was developed in the 70s and 80s and really caught on. During World War I, when veterans came home, they had something called shell shock. Now, what is shell shock? If you read, it is basically PTSD. But what happens is we have these big tragedies, and I do think I'm fair to say war, even if justified, is a tragedy. People experience considerable trauma, and then we forgot about it. So we talk about shell shock, but then as soon as the war gets over, we forget about it. We get into World War II. We, again, have a lot of battle fatigue, that they called it back then. And so I think what happened in the 1950s is we started to get honest about what was actually happening. And we began to recognize that there's a lot happening in this world. And we actually need to get down and address it. So in the 1959, in a world where there was a lot of change going on, we were beginning to recognize the dysfunction that happened. The organization recognized the need for change. So a study was done by the Child Welfare League of America, and based on results, the agency focus was changed from an orphanage to residential treatment. As time progressed, it became increasingly clear that treating the children in our care was multifaceted and comprehensive services that became integral as we expanded our ability to meet growing needs. Professionally trained caseworkers who understood the problems facing present-day children were employed. Foster care increased as a way to provide children from troubled homes with a stable home environment. A group home program was established to offer youth nurturing, structure, and guidance in a community-based setting. Counselors were hired to work with the children's family, school, pastor, and house parents. So we really have a move from sort of an institution where we just figure kids are kids and we treat them all the same to beginning to recognize that kids who have been through significant experiences sometimes need additional help to get by and additional training. As we come up to today and we talk about the kids who come and live at Berea Children's Home and what's we changed our name to Ohio Guidestone. I'll get into that in a moment, but we still have our Berea Children's Home in Berea. The kids who live there, I say what links them together is trauma. Kids who have grown up in very, very difficult environments, often in abject poverty. Kids who have had struggles with parents, some parents who have been addicted, some parents who have had mental health issues of their own that were never treated. And children who have been abused physically, emotionally, sexually. I specifically say sexual abuse because that is not a term that we at churches are comfortable talking about. And that's a term we need to be comfortable talking about. Not that we have to be comfortable with the concept, but the reality that it happens. And it happens so much and we don't talk about it. One of the other things I learned in the history of trauma was studying a little bit about Freud. Now, we all know Freud, and we all have some sense, perhaps, of some of his more outlandish theories, the Oedipal complex, where boys are supposed to fall in love with their mother, and it seems fairly far out. Now, what was really interesting is before Freud came up with those theories, a few years before that, he had settled onto a different theory. He had gone and talked to many of the women who were considered to be mentally insane, and he went and talked to them about their experience. And you know what they told them after gaining trust? Is that they had been sexually abused by members of their family and by close friends. So Freud published this information. He published his research saying what's really going on here is rampant sexual abuse all throughout society, among the poor, among the rich, in all places of the world. You know what they did with Freud? They stopped inviting him to their parties. They shut him out. The community ignored him. He wasn't the only one, but every single person who published this information found themselves ignored. And so Freud came up with a new theory, and they liked that theory, even if it wasn't really right. Actually, the women had told him what was going on. But they came up with it. And so this is a theme over and over again where we start to get close to it. We start to get close to sometimes the horrors of sexual abuse, the horrors of violence in war. But then it gets too messy and we back away and we come up with other excuses. And don't get me wrong, dealing with abuse is messy. It is. If we're going to be honest about it, working with kids who have been through a lot takes a lot. It takes a lot of training. It takes a lot of patience. And it takes a willingness to experience the anger that if you're really going to get to the issue that's there, the anger that they have towards their parents, the anger they have towards God, the anger they have towards anyone who's around because they just don't know. Just like when we as society begin to talk about it, we don't know what to do, so we want to walk away. These kids can't walk away. This was their life. This was their experience. And so we began to make the transition to really address some of that head on. Now, all throughout this time, up until the time period we're talking about, what at that time was Berea Methodist Children's Home, had been owned by the East Ohio Conference of the United Methodist Church. It was only in the 1980s that, and I think you guys will understand this, there was a lawsuit. And there was a lawsuit about a senior living facility that the Methodist Church owned that went bankrupt. And when they went bankrupt, the creditors came after the United Methodist Church. So the United Methodist Church said, okay, all you agencies, go be independent. We want to stay connected to you, but we don't want to own you anymore. And so they spun off all of these agencies, including Ohio Guidestone. But they spun it off in a special way so that we would continue to have a covenant relationship, is what we called it. So though we're no longer owned by the United Methodist Church, every 4 years, and this is one of the years in which we're at annual conference going to be reaffirming that covenant, that we have a special relationship because the United Methodist Church is the church that birthed us. And so we recognize that though we're independent, we're in this work together. So today, though faith is part of our heritage, operational philosophy, and value, and that through the Wesleyan values on which the agency was founded, Ohio Guidestone believes that faith can give strength to help with difficult situations and to take advantage of opportunities and that assists in treatment. Faith is a great grounding pole and an important part of our healing. So we are a faith-based organization that uses the best of therapy, that uses the best of science, that uses the best of neuroscience, that uses the best of all that we can to come together to help those in our midst. Now I'm going to pause for a second because I want to talk in a few minutes about all the different services that we have moved to beyond the children's home. And I want to talk about specifically about the services we're offering here in Portage County. But let me stop before I move from that sort of children's home era of talking about Ohio Guidestone and see what questions you might have or comments. I'm perfectly happy to have comments.
How is it funded?
How is it funded? The majority of our funding comes through Medicaid. And I think it's really important. There's actually going to be a resolution this year at the East Ohio Annual Conference that I helped author, but that is being offered up by the United Methodist Board of Church and Society and the United Methodist Board of Health and Welfare. When we begin talking about Medicaid and we begin talking about cutting Medicaid, we're talking about your United Methodist agencies because all of your United Methodist agencies, whether the children's home or whether the senior living facilities, have a commitment to serve those in poverty. And the primary way in which we fund services for those in poverty in this country is Medicaid. Medicaid has rates have largely remained steady since the 1990s. So imagine not receiving a raise since the 1990s. And then also the talk is often to cut it. So I'm glad you asked that because I always like to emphasize that that is our main source. Yes, we receive donation support. Yes, we receive for the children who live with us at the residential campus, there's some additional county level money that comes and helps to cover some of the clothing and food expense. But the vast majority of our services are paid through Medicaid. Other questions? So let me talk a little bit about what we're doing today. You see, it was in 2012 that the agency changed its name. It had been Berea Methodist Children's Home, if I'm getting that correctly. I might be missing a word in there. But we changed the name to Ohio Guidestone. Here's the reason why. Ohio Guidestone, which still has that Berea Children's Home campus as our heart of our organization, and that is where our headquarters is operated, now operates in about 20 counties in Ohio and serves, at last count, I believe, last fiscal year, 27,000 clients a year. Now, obviously, we don't have 27,000 clients shuffling through our Berea campus. But what we do is we begin to recognize that there are people who need help beyond that small group that come. And the group that come to Berea, we know, are coming in part because of untreated mental health and untreated addiction issues. And so very much in the Wesleyan spirit, we said, it's time to stop waiting for them to come to us. It's time for us to go to them. So just as Wesley left the church to go out into the fields to preach, so our therapists leave the office to go and provide the majority of the care in our client's home. So they go and they meet with the client in their home and provide therapy right there in the home. And our psychiatric, community psychiatric support team goes to the home and will often engage in skill building and teaching and playing games sometimes with kids and working with parents. So that right there in the home where they're going to live, we really get a chance to step into their lives. We recognized that high-quality childcare was lacking, and so we founded a number of different family life centers, that we call them, which are high-quality daycare centers for children to go. And we have begun and we have gone in a million different directions. But before, rather than tell you everything, let me just give you a list of what's available here in Portage County. Here in Portage County, we do home-based family treatment. So what I talked about, going in, working with the whole family on issues that are going on. We do counseling for adoptive families because we know that adoption is its own unique thing, and one has to learn how you become a family together. We do a lot of early childhood mental health. So sometimes we know, the science says, is that if we can get to kids when they're at 1 year old and 2 years old and 3 years old, that their brains still have a lot of developing to do. And so some of the missteps that might have happened in the first years of life, if we can identify and treat them then, we have a much better chance of helping them to live a much more normal life. We have maternal depression counseling here in Portage County. So we know that sometimes a certain percentage of mothers after giving birth experience postpartum depression. And it's really critical for the child's development that we get to those mothers and care for them there. We have PROTECT programs for both victims and offenders of sexual assault, especially who are kids. We know that if we don't address those things quickly and if we don't acknowledge what's there, we won't be able to help them much later in the process. We have Family Nurturing Centers of Ohio, so we offer parenting classes here in Portage County as they're available and requested. And finally, we have a workforce program. You saw a little bit of that workforce program before when they were talking about learning skills, and we've just in the last year opened this up in Portage County. And actually, right now, it's being hosted at Ravenna United Methodist Church is where we're doing some of it. And in fact, we're looking for more areas. So it might be a conversation we come to have at Kent sometime about providing some space for students. These are all young adults who are recommended through the Job and Family Services of Portage County, who then come and will be with us for a year or two. We'll get their GED if they don't already have it and learn the skills to really be able to get ahead in work. And so once we started coming to places like Portage County, it didn't make much sense to say Berea anymore. In fact, the best example I have is we in Columbus, our office in Central Ohio, when we opened the Columbus Berea Children's Home office, which wasn't in Berea and wasn't a children's home, the name just didn't make much sense anymore. And so we continue to be a United Methodist affiliated agency that is connected and is that we call Ohio Guidestone. The last thing I want to tell you about not because it's the biggest program, but because it's my program, is a little bit about spiritual care at Ohio Guidestone. Now, Ohio Guidestone has had a chaplain for the entirety of its history. In fact, for most of the history of Ohio Guidestone, a pastor, United Methodist elder, has been its CEO. Now, being a United Methodist elder, I'm fairly grateful that as we've emerged to be an organization that serves 27,000 clients a year and employs 1,200 people, that we no longer just have a United Methodist pastor as a CEO. We're trained to do a lot of things, but I was never trained in seminary to manage an organization this large. So I'm very grateful. Actually, funnily enough, it used to be you became the chaplain, and then later you became the CEO. And I'm really glad that that's not part of my future. But we always had one chaplain. So when I came 2.5 years ago, one of the things I recognized is Ohio Guidestone has just exploded, and we still have one chaplain. And we still say that spiritual care is available to all of our clients. Well, we mean it, but can we do it? So one of the things that I've really been working on is trying to expand spiritual care throughout our program. So one of the programs I'm most excited about, we received a grant from the Cuyahoga County Adams Board, which is the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board. I'm sure you have a similar board here in Portage County. And what they recognize is that spirituality is an important part of people's lives, yet it's a missing element when it comes to the treatment of mental health and addiction. Yes, 12-step programs do talk about spirituality, but in terms of actually funding care that incorporates spirituality, it's a missing element. So the Cuyahoga County Adams Board sought out contracts and awarded us a contract to integrate a clinically trained chaplain into the care of clients in Cuyahoga County in their homes. So I now have a few part-time chaplains who go out in Cuyahoga County, and for clients who want it, they go and they sit at the homes of those clients and they provide spiritual care right there. And they talk about life's wounds and they assess for what their core needs are. And they form a relationship of healing and hope around those needs. So I'm really excited that we've expanded that out. We now have an intern down in New Philadelphia where we have some treatment facilities and an intern down in Columbus. So we're really trying to grow so that spiritual care is not just part of our values, but as part of our care throughout the agency and is actually actualized. We certainly have some time for some more questions, and I have one more about 1 minute video to show you at the very end, but we can save it till a little bit later. So what other questions do you have? Yes.
I have a question about referrals.
Yeah.
Do they come primarily through other agencies, or how?
So we get referrals. We get a lot of referrals from agency. We get a lot of referrals from parents or children who might be caught up into the Job and Family Services or in the depending on the county, sometimes they have a separate Board of Child Welfare. We get a lot of referrals through that. We get a lot of people who self-refer, people who recognize that they're having problems and that they need help. And frankly, they want help that can come to their home and do it. There's a lot of stigma when it comes to mental health and addiction. And so one of the ways to help get beyond that is to have the person come to you and to provide the care right there in your home. So we do a lot through that. Even though we do receive the majority, most of our clients are Medicaid clients, which means that they live with under 138% of the poverty line. We do have clients who we do take other private insurances, and so we do see folks in a variety of different communities and at a variety of different settings.
I have a lot of government funding. I'm wondering how you do any religious training.
Well, the government does not actually forbid talking about spirituality. The government's concern is generally not favoring one type of spirituality over another. And so part of my training as a clinical chaplain, and most hospitals you go to, which receive the majority of their funding through insurance, also have chaplains. And so it's both my commitment, I guess at some level based on federal requirement, but also it's my commitment of how I be of the most effective chaplain I can be. The most effective chaplain I can be is I meet somebody where they are spiritually. It does someone no good when it's in the midst of crisis to come and tell them all their religious beliefs are wrong and they need to abandon it because all my beliefs are right. That doesn't do anyone much good. And it frankly isn't the way God worked. I know we're in Lent and not Advent, but when we think about Advent, we think about God coming in flesh into a specific community and adopting the religious traditions of that community, and that is how God operated. And so in a similar way, chaplains come in, and whether a client is Christian or Muslim or Jewish or Rastafarian, I've learned a lot about pagan, Satanist, wherever they are, I firmly believe God enters in to be with that person. God is incarnate right where that person is. The person doesn't have to jump over a bunch of hoops, doesn't have to profess a certain thing for God to be present, and so therefore neither do I or my chaplains. And so that's how it works, is I'm not there to make them to be the best Methodist they can be. I'm there to work with them to become the most connected to God as they can be, as they know God. Any other questions? I can see one back there. Okay. Seems like you were brimming with a question, but we're letting some other folks. All right. Well, why don't we play not the second video. We're going to skip that and just go straight to the third video, the Promise Run.
Let's hear it for the president and CEO, Rich Frank. Rich.
I don't know what you know about Ohio Guidestone. We serve over 25,000 people a year. We are there now to really try and transform communities. You will be helping our emergency fund, which generally helps any of our clients. Thank you very much for coming, and have a great time.
So I wanted to show that Promise Run video because it's one of the events that we have coming up, and there's a flyer. May 13th is when we're having our Promise Run. And the reason we call it our Promise Run is because we have a fund where we help, as we enter into the homes of clients, we know that they need more than mental health. We know they need more than addiction at times. They may not have any furniture at times. Their utilities may be shut off. And so we have a fund that in its origin, a lot of the employees contributed to, and now we try to fundraise toward to help to meet some of those other needs. Because we know it does us no good to address the mental health issues in a family if they can't eat and if they can't see because the lights are out and if they have no place to sleep. So this is our Promise Run, and we always encourage United Methodist Churches to come bring a team. Now, I don't know, and I don't want to make any assumptions. This may or may not be the core group of 5K and 10K runners in the congregation. We do have a 1 mile walk/run. We have Zumba. But what I would encourage you is if you know people in your congregation, or if you know some of the youth and young adults who come, if they are runners, send them our way. They're oftentimes, if people are runners, they're looking for opportunities to go and do things. And so we're happy to have them come out and learn a little bit about us and join us there in Berea. Aside from that, where we can really use your support, actually the number one resource we're lacking, it's not money, although we always can use some more money. It's not clients. The reality is that there are probably far more clients to serve than we have the capacity to. Our number one problem is staff. Let me put that a different way. Our biggest need is staff. we could hire probably 50 counselors tomorrow if the right 50 counselors came and applied. It depends on the program, but what we really need is folks to recognize, number one, those who are already serving in fields related to mental health, that I just think that we're a great organization that serves folks, not just at the upper end of the spectrum, but who have a real issues when it comes to poverty. And so we're just always looking for people who really see it as their calling to move beyond the office and serve folks in their homes, to go out in the community and follow what John Wesley told us to do and to go house to house. Only United Methodist elders take that vow to go house to house, but we're all called to get outside the doors of our congregations. And also to establish a culture long term that helps our kids and our grandkids to think about calling when they think about their vocation, to think and to live in a way that we don't say that it's just simply what pays the highest salary, but what brings the most fulfilling life and helps us to make the most difference. And so we're always looking for folks, and there are usually always programs, both folks who have a license for therapy, but also folks who don't have a license. There are ways that we want to use people who have a heart for this type of work. All right. I'll give it one last opening for questions. All right. Well, then I thank you for your invitation to come out. And I'll be around if you have any questions that you were too timid to raise up here in the group. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the United Methodist Church of Kent Sermon Podcast. For more information about the church and to read Dr. Palmer's notes from the pastor blog with more about today's topic, visit www.kentmethodist.org.